That's Egypt, and Egypt is seeing themselves like that. And so servants or shepherds, these people are considered to be a lower class thing. You know, we don't do things like that, live with animals and stuff. You know, we are too classy for that. We have nice houses in the city and stuff like that, right? So he's telling them to explain that and how to explain it, because two things are happening. First of all, they've got a lot of livestock and crops. So they're about to fill an area of Egypt. We don't know how big it is, but it's going to be bigger than a bread box, okay? They're going to fill an area of Egypt up. And they have to have the arable land, the land that's near the Nile, the land that's why they're up north where the Nile spreads out, because you get a whole lot more arable land. So they're about to use a mass quantity of this land for all these animals, right? So that's about to come under question, because they're not only taking room for themselves, they're taking probably 10 times that amount of space for the animals. You know, we can live in a small cabin, but the horses can't, the cows can't, you know, they need more space. So if you're living on a ranch, most of the space is for the animals, and there's a house and a garage for the people, right? So they're about to take a whole bunch of space up. And the shepherds are considered to be an abomination to the Egyptians. So Joseph went and told Pharaoh. We're in the next chapter now, 47. Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flocks and herds and all they possess have come from the land of Canaan. Indeed, they are in the land of Goshen." He took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" And they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to dwell in the land because your servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." So this is a really tricky little maneuver. Keep in mind that Joseph is the son of Jacob, the guy with the weird skin, okay? He's got tricks. And this is the trick. Shepherds, being low-lifes, low-quality, second-class citizens, are not a threat. He didn't say, "I've come with my father and his family and our giant army," right? "We have 10,000 spears." He didn't say all of that. He said, "We're just shepherds. We just need some room for our flocks." And so that means that they're going to get a lot of prime land as part of the deal. So he's about to give his people a prime chunk of real estate, and he's going to get the Pharaoh to agree. And the Pharaoh's and he's going to be, "Oh, we're just shepherds, so we're not, you know, in any kind of any kind of threat to you. But also, we're shepherds, and so we need land for our flocks." So the Pharaoh says to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. If you know any competent men among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock." So this guy, I love this Pharaoh, by the way. I'm going to give you a guess at his name, just a guess. But I love this Pharaoh. And the reason I love this Pharaoh so much is because all through the Bible, there's these guys who aren't people of God necessarily, but they just get it, you know? And he just gets it. He's like, you know, Joseph, everything Joseph touches becomes awesome. He saves Egypt. He makes more grain. So I'm just going to give him my flocks. If he's got a whole family of Josephs and they're going to raise livestock, they're going to be blessed. They're going to have better livestock and more livestock. So why don't y'all just take care of my stuff too? But what that does in reality is it gives Joseph's family power, not only over their own stuff and all the land they've been given, but they're taking care of the Pharaoh's livestock. So that, what does that mean? If you take two herds and put them in the same land, after a couple years, can you tell them apart? I mean, they're going to interbreed, right? That's going to become both of their property. And the Pharaoh's down with that. He has no problem with that, because he knows if he asks Joseph for whatever, he's going to get it. So my point in saying all this stuff is how good this Pharaoh is at really getting who Joseph is, and how much power Joseph and his family are getting. And since all these people moved in from, and it says it multiple times, people from Canaan coming in, they are from Canaan, they are here now, give them all this land. It does sound like if you were looking at that in an archaeological record, it might look like an invasion or a takeover. It is indeed like, and it might be a passive version, but it is indeed an invasion and a takeover, right? So I just tracked this. And I believe that that everything kind of makes sense. When you look back at the history of it, you look at what's happening, you know, when Jacob's coming in, when these intermediate periods are happening. I'll give you an example. Remember Ur of the Chaldees, you know, Abraham's birthplace? Remember how that was such a big deal, and then they spread out up into different areas, and then they went back and forth a lot? Just a side archaeological note. The Ur was destroyed in 1900 BC. Now, it's destroyed because of a war, but in our biblical understanding, it's destroyed because they don't need that anymore. All that stuff, all that Abrahamic background is done. They're going into Egypt now. They're going to disappear into Egypt for 400 years. We don't need any of that background stuff. There's no connections anymore. Everybody that ever mattered is all in Egypt. And that's fascinating to me. Something around 1878, 1860, Joseph arrives. The pharaohs of the time have these different names, but they don't seem to have a whole lot of power, okay? And you have some different names like Sobekari and Sopnefru and Mekenheru. But here's the thing that I find fascinating. If the Egyptology record and our biblical record and all the timeline we've been doing cross-reference properly, which they seem to do, then the Pharaoh that, you're going to love this, the Pharaoh that Joseph's hanging out with, there's a couple of them, and their name is Amenemhat. Amenemhat III and Amenemhat IV. And the reason you recognize that name is because way, 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 way in the future, there's going to be a pharaoh who's going to have a firstborn son that he's going to name after the pharaohs at the end of the previous dynasty, and he's going to name his firstborn son Amenemhat. And that firstborn son is going to die in the 10th plague. We have a name connection again. No one knows that except you guys, okay? Because Egyptology has their record, and biblical scholars have their record, and never the twain shall meet, okay? But Amenemhat III and Amenemhat IV are ruling as the 1800s wind down, and we get into they're the last rulers. The very last one is his sons, Sopekare and Senekeltawe, and these guys are like really weak, and that's how it all ends before the intermediate period. Intermediate period starting almost exactly 1800-ish BC. Okay, so they're there for several years, you know, something along the lines of 50 to 70 years prior to the intermediate period beginning, which is fine because right now in the place we're in, Egypt's fine. Pharaoh's fine. Food is fine. Joseph's in charge. Everything's fine. But Pharaoh just said, you know, you're good to go. You can have it all. Take the best land. Take my stuff with you. Make some of your guys, if they're really good, make them chief herdsmen, give them titles. Joseph brought his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. I love this. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130. So we have a date for this meeting. It's 130 years after whatever that means, the years of my pilgrimage. So it might be his birth. It might be his when he left to go wandering around looking for things and doing what he did. But it's at least 130 years after the birth, and probably, could be older than that. But if it was 130 years after Jacob's birth, what year would it be?
1876 BC.
And we've established that somewhere in the 1870s is when this should be happening. So we went at it from two different directions, and it seems to fit perfectly. So around 1876, 1878, something in that 1870s range.
And that gives us the date when the famine started too.
Yep. And that's matched by historical climatology. They have a period of several different of these aridification events. The big one was the one that had Abraham on the move. Then there's some smaller ones that they're like echoes. And we're in one of those. It's a 14-year long deal, give or take. We're in this where there's a cycle. And this happens. This is why dating the flood is so hard. The reason dating the flood is so hard is all the people always live on the on water that floods all the time. So you've got hundreds of floods of the Nile, hundreds of floods of the Tigris and Euphrates, hundreds of floods of all the places that we had people. So we don't know which of those floods was the big one. You know, so it's really hard to date a flood when everything's flooding all the time, right? We know this was the biggest flood. But when you're looking at a bunch of different sediments, it's really, you know, dig a core down and look at sediment, it's really hard to figure out which one of those is the big boy. But we're somewhere, but 3100, 3200 BC for the flood, give or take. Probably can't be earlier than 3900, because that is another aridification event, and the world was very dry. It's probably not then. And it's probably not after 3100, later, because that's when we have all the people settling in cities and developing writing. So we've got humanity, evidence of humanity coming into light in 3100, 3000 being a real anchor point for the world. So humanity explodes around 3100 or so. So we're looking at maybe a 3300. If somebody put a gun to my head and said, tell me when the flood was, I would say 3300 BC, give or take. That would be my guess. But anyway, this all matches. It all matches. So anyway, he says 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of my life and my father's in the days of their pilgrimage. So Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. So that is a little surly, okay, his commentary. He's old, he's 130, and he's looking back at his life. Think about this. He looked back at all that weird, shady stuff he did and wrestling with God. And you know, he's happy. He's proud of everything that's happened. He loves everything that's happened. He's glad that his son's alive. All these beautiful blessings from God, but he doesn't really feel like they're his. You understand what I mean? Like, he doesn't really deserve them. He thinks about his life, and he's like, this has been my life, and it's kind of crappy compared to my father's. I didn't do the things that Abraham did. I didn't do the things that Isaac did. I'm not as good of a man, basically, as my father's. Even though he is, he's a big deal. But he remembers all that stuff. He feels, you know, weird about his life. Like, he's not that proud of some of the stuff he's done, basically. It's what that means. He's had some trouble in his life, and he doesn't feel that proud of it. But he's still proud enough to bless Pharaoh. And he can bless Pharaoh, because he's still the chosen one of God. There's another one coming up now, his son. But he's still Jacob. He's still, you know, one of the patriarch of God, basically, right? So Joseph situated his father and his brothers, gave them possession in the land of Egypt, the best of the land of Ramses. Now, this is the important. This is your cross reference. Remember how everybody got confused when they read that the Israelites were building the city of Ramses, they put the Exodus with Ramses. Well, that's not how this reads, because this is 400 years before and it's being called the land of Ramses. So now we have the complete answer, because we get Ramses mentioned here, and that fixes everything. Now, I don't know why people don't read that or get that, but here's the deal. The reason it's referred to as Ramses, because who is writing the first five books? Moses. And what is happening when they're going to settle in? And what do we know about those five books? We know that he didn't finish them, that someone else after him continued to write them, because we have stories of his death and how he was buried and everything. He didn't write about his own death and burial. Okay, so we know that Joshua or someone else helped finish the books and organize the books into what we know as the Pentateuch. That person or persons was doing so from the comfort of Israelite possessions in the Holy Land. So Joshua invades, Moses dies, Joshua invades. They're telling those stories in those books. So we know that although the books don't cover much after that, that we're going to pick up other books like Joshua, okay? We're going to pick up other books. But this thing has been written in the time that the Israelites are finished, in the time that the Israelites are in the Holy Land. And who's in charge? The most powerful person in the world at that time. And we're talking about around that 1200 time frame, give or take. The most powerful person in the world, the most powerful people in the world are the Ramses dynasty. So what are they saying right here? They're saying that the land of Ramses, where Ramses would rule, where the greatest, most healthy, wonderful place in Egypt was, where he would build his big city, this area known as the heart of Ramses, because he is the biggest, most powerful thing in the world, and this is his greatest possession, that they're there. So it's making a point. It's making a point of how big a deal it is and how major it is. How good is the land that Joseph gave his people? How good is the area that they settled in? It's the area of Ramses, the greatest ruler of all time. And Ramses is still considered to be one of the greatest rulers, if not the greatest ruler of all time. So that's why you get a reference. It's also to help us understand that when they say those guys were working on the city of Ramses, they're talking about those guys are working on what would be the city of Ramses and the place that would be the place of Ramses. That's how big a deal that city was. That's how cool that was. That doesn't mean we shift the Exodus 200 years to Ramses. It means that everything they're doing while they're there before the Exodus is that important. They're living in the land that would be Ramses. They're constructing the city that would be Ramses. And what is the city that would be Ramses? It's a storehouse city. And what did Joseph build? A bunch of storehouse cities. So it's perfect. But it confuses people. Before we move too far on, the other thing that confuses people is in the previous chapter in the list of all the folks. It says, and so-and-so was the son of so-and-so, and they had boo-boo-boo-boo-bah, right? And then it says, the sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, Merari, and the Kohath. Now you go forward into the time of Moses, and it says Moses' grandfather's name is Kohath. And so this caused immediate problems because people took the two names and matched them. They said, okay, so the guy that comes in with Jacob is Moses' grandfather. Therefore, they can't have been in the land in Egypt more than 100 years. So they settled on 125 or something like that, people that went with that. The problem is that the Bible says different. And I think there's a very easy explanation for that, because we see several names repeated. We see a couple different names where we have the same person named, slightly different things. For instance, we have multiple Johns, we have multiple Josephs, all kinds of people with different names. Joseph, the Joseph that went into Egypt was not this Joseph that married Mary, right? We know that, right? So that's, they're both Joseph. Well, why was Joseph, the husband of Mary, named Joseph? After the Joseph, because Joseph was awesome, right? And so, why not have four generations later another Kohath named after Kohath? I think the Kohath that's mentioned as Moses' grandfather is maybe the great-great-great-great-grandson of the Kohath mentioned with Jacob. But they have people named, multiple people named multiple names. You know, we know a bunch of, there's a bunch of James, there's a bunch of Johns, there's a bunch of everybody, you know. I mean, Matthew's name is Levi. That's not the same Levi. You understand what I mean? People name after cool people. So if Kohath came in as the son of Levi, Levi's a big deal, right? And Kohath comes in as the son of Levi, and the Levites are a big deal, and Kohath is cool, and he has a great-great-grandson, they name him Kohath. I'm not mad at him. People do that all the time. There's a really famous chef's that they were the first people to get three Michelin stars in England, and they're called the Roux brothers, and their name are Albert and Michel Roux. And Albert's the older brother, Michel's the younger brother. And they have they're older now, passed away and everything, but Albert's son is named Michel Jr. He named him literally Jr. too. So Albert's son is named Michel Jr. Michel has a bunch of sons with no Michel names. Okay, I mean, we name people after people we love or care about. We name them after grandparents, great-grandparents all the time. And so did the Israelites. So to me, that's the Kohath or Kahath problem. You know, they don't have vowels are tricky in Hebrew, so Kohath or Kahath. But that's the Kohath problem. People believe if it's the same Kohath, they can't be there longer than 150 years. But I believe it's a different Kohath. Anyway, that I just wanted to point that out, and that's that whole connection with the Kohath thing. But anyway, so now Joseph's going to go out and deal with the famine. His father's household is established and settled in. Now there was no bread anywhere in the land because the famine was very severe. Okay. The land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan. Joseph gathered up all the money. Like all the money. Okay? That was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan. For the grain which they bought. And Joseph bought the money into Pharaoh's house. So he basically collects basically all the money because everybody's trying to buy grain and survive, and they're paying for it. So there's all this grain being sold. There's all this stuff that he had put in storage. They're the only people that have anything, and basically he collects it all. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, because everybody's out of money, this is like complete economic collapse. It's like the Great Depression, okay? Complete economic collapse. All the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed." Okay. Then Joseph said, "Give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for their horses and flocks and cattle and herds and donkeys. And he fed them with bread for all the livestock they had that year. Joseph is racking it up. This is like the first Rockefeller, okay? He is just rolling. For that year it ended and came to him the next year and said, "We will not hide from my Lord that our money is gone, but the Lord also has herds of livestock. So nothing left in the sight of my Lord." So they got nothing. They got no money, and now they've got no livestock. So why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt from Pharaoh. Are you reading this? Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. Okay? For every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was so severe. So the land, all of it became Pharaoh's. And this is a powerful, powerful Pharaoh. But to me, this is also indication of a major political strife, right? You got so much drama going on. No wonder you're about to go into an intermediate period. What do you do after all this? So now the land is Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them to the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had rations allotted to them by Pharaoh, and they ate their rations which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their lands. There is record that there were some periods of time in Egypt where the priests were operating almost as pharaohs because they were so powerful, because they had all this stuff. And this is an indication that that is probably true, and the time frame is like that. Then Joseph said to the people, "Indeed, I have bought you and your land. Okay, look, here is a seed for you, and you shall sow the land. It shall come to pass in the harvest, you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh, four-fifths shall be your own, as seed for the field and for your food, for those of your households and food of your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And Joseph made the law over the land to this day that Pharaoh should have one-fifth except the land, the priest only, which it did not become Pharaoh's. Now, there's a whole lot. I told you that this section, even though it appears to be like Joseph taking care of the famine and, you know, Jacob's moving in, there's a lot of depth here. What's just happened is all the people of Egypt, they were, a lot of them were middle class. They had land and possessions of their own. And all their land and possessions is now reverted to Pharaoh, and they themselves, their persons, have now reverted to Pharaoh. So what Joseph has done is not only make the Pharaoh real happy, but secure the land of Egypt by making an absolute monarchy out of it. Okay, it was a Pharaoh ruling a group of people that did what the Pharaoh said, but they had their own stuff. There were people making carpets, there were people making boats, there were people raising donkeys. Everybody's got a job. But now everything they do is for Pharaoh. So he's created an absolute monarchy. Now, I would say, anthropologically, and this is a guess, but what he did was basically set up everybody to be kind of servants or slaves, okay? Now, they're happy because they lived, but how happy are they going to be a few years from now? I would offer the idea that when this gets done, it saves everybody's lives. It's awesome. It makes the Pharaoh real happy. But when the Pharaoh falls and changes, the people are not happy. And the people they're not going to be happy with are the Israelites. And the Israelites are not only going to come under racist, probably, attacks and doctrine and laws, but probably end up subjugated, like Joseph had, not in a bad way, but Joseph had subjugated the people. Not in a bad way, he saved their lives. But he did in effect subjugate them. Okay? So you see how that creates a different world? Also, I want to point out that on the other side of this we have Ahmosis, one of the most powerful pharaohs of all time, the Amenhoteps, the Akhenatens, the Tutmoseses, and the Ramses. So I believe that part of their power was set in play by what Joseph has done, because he's kind of solidified the power of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's gone from a title of like a mayor to like overlord. You understand? So I don't know. That's all speculation, but it seems to feed in. It certainly makes sense that Ahmosis is known for throwing out the who is Moses's dad. He starts the 18th dynasty. Why? Because he throws out all Canaanites from Egypt. He expels all Canaanites from Egypt. Now, the Israelites are still there. So is there two different groups of Canaanites? Or what does that mean? But what we know is that's a definition of why they would be enslaved and why it would be so bad. You know, that's, you know, they're going to be beaten, Israelites. That's why Moses kills the guy, right? When he's 40. So they've got a common pattern of enslaving and beating these guys. So this all could be part of the same story. So let's look at this. So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there and grew and multiplied exceedingly. So they're super powerful, super healthy, super happy, best land, best houses, multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years, okay? So he's got 17 more years after he was kind of on his last legs. The length of Jacob's life is 147 years. So that's when we figure out that he means his entire life by that story, by that number. When the time draws near that Israel must die, he calls his son Joseph and says to him, "Now, if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. You shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." And he said, "I will do as you said." So he does a swearing thing where your hand is under the thigh, and it's a swearing thing. "I will do as you have said." Then he said, "Swear to me." And he swore to him. So Israel bowed himself on the head of the bed. So we know that no matter what happens at the end of Genesis, Joseph's going to take Jacob and bury him in his father's because he swore to him. And Joseph's not the guy to not do what he says. Now it came to pass after these things, and that could be a pretty lengthy period of time. We don't know for sure, but it could be 5 minutes or 5 days or 5 years. But now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, "Indeed, your father is sick." He took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, "Look at your son Joseph. Your son Joseph is coming to you." And Israel strengthened himself and sat up in bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you of a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession.' And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine." And this is where the 12 tribe confusion happens, right? Because he basically makes them his sons equal to Reuben and Simeon. "Your offspring, whom you beget after them, shall be yours. They will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath," that is, Bethlehem. Then Israel saw Joseph's sons, who said, "Who are these?" And Joseph said to his father, "These are my sons, whom God has given me in this place." And he said, "Please bring them to me, and I will bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, "I had not thought to see your face, but in fact God has also shown me your offspring." So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, "God, before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." See, this is really relevant for two big reasons. Theologically, it's relevant because we had a history up till this time of the people that were being tracked in the lineage going back to the source to get wives. You know, Isaac, you know, and you know, Rebecca. And the whole story of how, you know, Jacob had taken his journey to get his wives. And everybody had to have wives from the same source. And what's happened is Joseph is the next leader, right? And he has not done that. He has wives that are Egyptian. And he has two kids that were born in Egypt. They're Egyptian. These kids are Egyptian. They speak Egyptian. They look Egyptian. They're Egyptian. But That doesn't mean they're not part of the family of God. This is the first time that this has happened, where in the patriarchal lineage, people that were not necessarily from the line of God directly were brought into the family. Now, this is foreshadowing of us, of Gentiles, right? So there's an important theological reason for all this. But there's also an important sort of literary reason for this. Because there's a blessing with Jacob and Joseph. And there's a blessing with Jacob and Isaac. And you remember how Jacob got his blessing. And his father couldn't see very well. Remember? And so he came in there and kind of disguised himself as his brother and sort of jacked the blessing. And now we're seeing a reflection of this. But this new blessing, the father still has bad eyesight. They're still bringing far with the kids. But in this blessing, the son is bringing his two sons. He's kneeling down. He's bringing them close. He's connecting the hands. There's no fake skin. Okay? There's none of that. It's pure and perfect. But they're not from the family line they're supposed to be from. So that's why it needs to be done. But that's why it's confusing. So you have got a major impact from this passage, because this is a passage that proves, let's take Judaism. There's a historical relevance to this, because you can bring people in to Judaism. You don't have to be born a Jew to be Jewish. You can go and do all the things that need to be done and become a Jew, right? There's a precedent being set here, because these guys are Egyptians and they're now going to be part of the inheritors of the land, a part of the Abrahamic blessing. And that's a big deal. And that's why it's in here. It's in here because it needs to be clear that even though Joseph's life situation was hectic, and even though he had to go to Egypt, and even though that happened in the hectic way it happened, and even though he got his wife and kids in Egypt in a hectic way, everything was different about this, that's still God's plan. And these kids, these two guys, are God's plan. So Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim. It displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand and removed it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is firstborn. Put your right hand on his hand." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." So what's happening? What's happening is he's blessing them, and they have a tradition for which hand to switch and how you do stuff, like put your hand under my thigh and right hand on the guy and blah, blah, blah. And he's doing it backwards. And they're like, why? But this is clearly, Jacob's on the edge of on deathbed, right? He is clearly so close to God right now. He's already been prophetic. He's already wrestled with God and talked to God for hundreds of times throughout his life. So he's already a super prophet as it is. But he's on the edge of death. His prophetic quality is so high right now that he's doing this backwards on purpose. Because he knows that even though this son is younger, he's going to have an even greater multitude. He's going to be even greater than his brother. So he blessed him that day, saying, and I love how Joseph is trying to correct him. So Joseph's trying to correct him because he wants everything to be done correctly, but he's not in charge. God is in charge, and Jacob's in charge, right? And so he says, I know, but here's the deal. They're both blessed, but the young one's going to be blessed even more. By you, Israel would bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Then he flipped it, right? Now, obviously there's another thing happening here that I got to point out. Jacob. What's the story of Jacob? The younger one was set before the older one. The younger one became more powerful than the older one. So there's a subtext. Obviously God's in charge, because that's what happens. Okay, Jacob's not making it up. I mean, it happens. So it's prophetic. But also, it's reflective. It's not just prophetic, it's reflective of his life. Except now, it's on purpose. It's not Isaac's can't see, accident, loves some stew. It's not that story. It's on purpose. And the second is going to go before the first. And so Jacob had his brother, and they went to his father, and they had the blessings, and he and Jacob was the blessed one put first. And by, you know, dicey means. And now his firstborn of his true love, Rachel, his greatest son, Joseph, the one who's the ruler of Egypt, right? He has two sons. And the same basic thing is about to happen, but on purpose. And this is sort of like a, you know, it's sort of like a, like, I don't know, a trend or a sign of the lineage being continued, or whatever you want to call it. But that's just amazing to me, that reflection of how that works. And now it's being done purposefully. But then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given you one portion above your brothers, which I took from my hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow." So this is a little bit different. So Jacob says to Joseph, "I'm dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and bow." He's referring to evidently some type of, you know, war type of thing we don't know much about. I mean, we know that these people existed and there were conflicts, but we don't know exactly what this is. But what it means is there's now an extra portion. He's also got two kids that have now been made kids. So we've got a very confusing lineage. Instead of 12 tribes, we've got one of those tribes being split into two, but then an extra portion being added. So it's basically 13 tribes plus maybe an extra guy. So it's pretty confusing. It's pretty confusing. But he says there's an extra portion, which he took. So he's saying, I expanded the realm that God promised us by the sword. That doesn't really work like that. I mean, it's cool. That's cool, but it doesn't really work like that. And they're not going home for 400 years. So it's going to be a lot more complicated than that. But that is a foreshadowing, if you will, to the work of David and the work of Solomon and the work of Joshua. Because they're going to fight Amorites. They're going to fight a whole bunch of tribes. And they're going to expand the Holy Land in all directions. And they're going to, you know, they're going to make all this space. They're going to have this amazing, giant, beautiful kingdom with all these tribes involved. It's going to be complicated. It's going to split after Solomon. It's going to come under subjugation from, you know, Babylonians and Assyrians and everybody else. It's not going to be a fun journey, but for a few years, it's going to be awesome. And the entire point is they do get the land. They're sitting on it right now. The descendants of these people are sitting on it right now. And there's been a lot of hiccups along the way. There's hiccups right now. There's about to be a big hiccup for 400 years. But there's another hiccup in the 30s and, you know, 1939 to 1945. There's another hiccup. There's plenty of hiccups in this history. But the fact is, there they were, and there they are, and there they're going to be. So that is established by God. It's not going to be changing, even though it's going to go up and down and there's going to be fortune and fate and all kinds of problems. It's not going to change the will of God. So it's after 8 now, so we'll call it for tonight. But we've got it down to the last two chapters, and we're going to say goodbye to Jacob and hello to slavery. But we'll finish Genesis next Wednesday night. Does anybody have any questions or comments? It's a really dense material because everybody summarizes it. Oh, Jacob moves to Israel. Yeah, that, yeah, Jacob moves over to Egypt. Yeah, that's true. But there's all these details about where they move and how big it is and how they work it out and how the blessings go on to his sons. And all those details are so reflective of everything. There is a... as you know, it's an Amorite chieftain. You know how I'm talking about the Amorites? It's an Amorite chieftain, just total archaeological geek side note. It's an Amorite chieftain in 1894 who breaks off a sub-kingdom that will become Babylon. So they're leaving the Holy Land. And the guys are already stirring in the kings of Larsa and the Amorite rulers of Mesopotamia are already stirring to create the early stuff that will become Babylon. So we're going to see a full circle. We're going to have slavery, then we're going to have Joshua, then we're going to have judges, then we're going to have a kingdom, then we're going to split, and then we're going to have, this is all going to come back around as Babylon comes, and we're going to end up with Daniel working for Nebuchadnezzar or whatever, right? I mean, this is a big full circle type of thing we're dealing with for 1,000 years. It's all interconnected. Anyway, we'll continue next time, and thank you all for walking through this. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for tonight. It literally seems like 30 seconds since I prayed. We get so excited about the Word and so blessed by having access to all the things you've given us, whether it's the knowledge or the history or the Word itself. There's just so much for us, so much food and nourishment for our souls and our minds, and just things that bring us closer and closer to you, that see more details of the world you have made and how you've made it and all these things. The story of the Bible, which is the story of you and us and how it all works. It's just it's a blessing beyond our ability to even understand. And we just thank you from the bottom of our hearts for all of it. We love you so much. Bless everyone here. Protect them as they come and go, as they travel for holidays, and there's weather, and there's cars, and there's finances, and just everything. Just protect them and give them a joyous, wonderful Christmas season as we celebrate the birth of your son and how he came here and all that he did. And we just thank you for your word and this time together. You've blessed us so greatly with this place, and we love you so much. We thank you in the mighty name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.